We started with 17 kids. And by the time I finished my first book, it was like 30 kids and it come 40, and kids keep on coming.
Reading out loud to kids in Haiti. Even the teenagers stick around to listen.
For the 1 hour that we have them kids over here, they will forget about everything. It's guaranteed.
And Tapachula, Mexico is the last stop on a long journey for Africans heading for America.
I have nothing left. I have left only 100 pesos for the taxi to travel to the airport.
And another weary traveler is happy to hear a language she understands.
After 3 months on the road, passing through 5 countries and 8 languages, it's comforting to wrap myself in familiar sounds, to feel at home in the grammar crackling around me.
Je voudrais saluer le courage.
Oui, mais ma sango qui te kodo
pas. Around the world with the World Vision Report, I'm Peggy Waymeyer. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Tapachula, Mexico is just a few miles from the Guatemalan border, and it's become a way station for Central American migrants heading north through Mexico to America. But if you stroll through the town square in Tapachula these days, it's not just Guatemalans, Hondurans, and Salvadorans you'll see. Africans have started showing up. They're making this town a base, too, as they head for America. Grant Fuller reports on the amazing length some Africans have gone to get this far.
A marimba band performs near Tapachula's main square, where African migrants like to hang out. The vast majority of them come from Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia. And the path they've taken to get here is circuitous, to say the least.
I started from Ethiopia to Kenya, Kenya to Tanzania, Tanzania to Malawi,
Cuba, Ecuador, Ecuador, Colombia, Panama.
Mexico, I'm going to now America, yeah. It's a long journey.
I was leaving my country in 2005.
At a seedy hotel near the plaza, 24-year-old Fikr Mariam Badada tells me his story. He's escaping the dictatorship at home in Ethiopia. As a supporter of a pro-democracy party, he says he had to leave to avoid arrest and torture. The Ethiopian government wouldn't have issued him a passport, so he's traveling with a fake one. You may ask, why not get on a plane straight to the U.S. with that? Well, while you can apply for asylum with a fake passport, you have to be on American soil to do it. But airport immigration is considered international territory. So if Badada took a flight directly to the States and his fake passport was discovered, he'd be sent right back where he came from. So he's left with only one option. Sneak across the border from Mexico and seek asylum once he's officially inside the United States. Badada paid close to $10,000 for smugglers to get him here. And along the way, from one country to the next, he never knew who would pick him up or where they were going.
They take us to the hotel. We spend some days there. After that, we keep traveling. They give you for another smugglers, and they help you to cross the border, and they give you for the other smugglers.
The smugglers send them through countries with lax security, places where corruption is rampant, where a fake passport and a little bribe will do the trick. To make the trip, Badada saved money by running a small dry goods store in South Africa. Then a friend helped him when he ran out of cash, buying him a plane ticket from here to Reynosa in northern Mexico on the border with the United States.
I have nothing left. I have left only 100 pesos for the taxi to travel to the airport. It's been almost 5 years traveling all over the world. I've been in the jail, I've been robbed. I see a lot of things, and I don't afraid anything. It's good experience, especially for the young guy like me. I learned a lot of things, and I made a lot of friends, you know, made me strong.
It's pouring rain outside a hole-in-the-wall Mexican restaurant where half a dozen Africans are eating lunch. 27-year-old Asayas, he didn't give his last name, is from Eritrea. With broken Spanish and hand signals, he's able to order the same beef plate he got here yesterday.
There's a lot of problem in Eritrea, religion problem, and military problem. It's in Eritrea government, you know, it's the already dictator at this time. If you want, he can kill you. If you want, he can arrest you. Whatever he wants, he can do.
The waitresses watch with amusement as Asayas scarfs down spicy meat and tortillas. Like most Africans who come through Tapachula, Asayas turned himself in to immigration. Mexico has one of the world's strictest immigration policies. So instead of granting political asylum, authorities here prefer to give migrants like Asayas a 30-day permit to get out of the country and try their luck in the United States. With that piece of paper, Esaias is able to travel on a flight to northern Mexico. From there, he'll cross the border into Texas illegally and seek asylum, just like Badada plans to do. As the rain picks up outside the restaurant, Esaias says he expects things to go well in Texas.
I have much confidence for U.S., you see. If you have a problem, they can accept you. I know in television about America is peace for life. For life is very safety in America, yeah.
Esaias and his travel buddies are hesitant to talk, scared of creating trouble after they've made it so far. After all this time, they're finally nearing the finish line.
I feel good, you see. I passed a long journey and I entered here. It's a gift of God. Only I want to say thanks God. Yeah, I get it by peace. Only is my new life here for me.
The Hotel Tacaná is one of several budget hotels on this street where smugglers drop off Africans. Manager Margarita Villatoro keeps a map of the United States at the front desk.
They ask me to do them a favor and show them where Texas is, or Florida, Miami, Los Angeles. Sometimes they ask me if it's better to go through Piedras Negras or Tijuana, and I tell them to be very careful if they go through Tijuana because it's one of the cities with a lot of crime these days.
Villatoro says she has great respect for her African guests. That's because she's been a migrant herself. She made it to the U.S. and lived there for 8 years.
Aside from all the money you spend, you're far from your family, leaving behind your parents, your house, and you go to another place, not knowing if you're going to succeed or fail. So I admire those people. They come from so far away, so we have to find a way to support our African brothers.
Fikru Mariam Badada, the man from Ethiopia, shares the backseat of a taxi with a friend. They've decided to take the final step of their journey together. Badada has big dreams for the future. One day, he hopes to go back home and work for change.
I want to teach my people. I want to show them how the freedom is. Because most of Ethiopians, I don't know about freedom. We have the story of 3,000 years. We don't have freedom. I want to go back to fight by a peaceful way. I want to continue fighting for my freedom, the liberation of my Ethiopian people.
But as he arrives at the airport and gives the taxi driver his last few pesos, Badada knows he's got a different fight to win first. He shows his 30-day permit to an immigration officer in the terminal and is waved through. Another hurdle cleared. Next up, the U.S. border, and finally, an answer to his long quest for asylum. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Tapachula, Mexico.
Sometimes immigrants have to bribe officials to get what they need, but so do ordinary Mexicans. Here's our globe at a glance. Mexico has been struggling with corrupt cops. Mexican police officers regularly pull over drivers for breaking traffic laws, whether the driver's guilty or not. The officers will offer to tear up the tickets for a small fee. Now, the iPhone could help. A new app gives details of traffic and parking regulations and a list of appropriate fines, so drivers can now arm themselves with this information and challenge the policeman. There's also a corruption hotline, so a driver can report a bribery attempt instantly. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Waymire. You heard in our first story that Africans trying to get to America had traveled through as many as 10 to 15 countries. That means 10 or 15 different languages to contend with. Gina Moore is a journalist who lives in Rwanda and travels in Africa on reporting trips. She's often in a situation where she can't speak the local language. But she says she finds a beauty in words she doesn't know.
I have always been jealous of people who can casually slip between three or four tongues, and I've spent the last few months needing them. I'm a reporter, and I've been traveling around a handful of African countries for an article about peace building. I've needed an interpreter for everything from the Sango language of Central Africa to the Pidgin Portuguese of Guinea-Bissau. While I've been at the mercy of people more linguistically talented than I, a friend of mine in Sierra Leone speaks something like near a half dozen languages fluently. He can make his way almost anywhere he goes in the world. Sure, he told me, his ear for the foreign might be enviable. But then he told me something I'd never thought about before. You lose something about a language when you're able to speak it, something you can never have at all with your native tongue. I can't tell you how Arabic sounds, he said. To me, it just sounds like how people should speak. I love this reflexive confidence in one's first language. I love that I can hear a melody in his Arabic that he can't, or that I can find some poetry that's lost on the speakers of Portuguese who chatter around me in the cafes of Guinea-Bissau. I love that there might be a secret splendor, even, dare I say it, in Dutch. But now I'm sitting at a hotel cafe in Kigali, Rwanda, which is where I live. There's a couple to my left speaking German, my first foreign tongue. They're speaking a bit too quietly for me to get every word, and I don't understand every word I get, but I feel at ease. I feel that satisfied relief that floods your body when you finally bend your knees and sit after a day-long hike. And I know I'm home when I hear Kinyarwanda, the local language. It lilts, and listening to it feels like traveling up and down the famous thousand hills of the countryside. My vocabulary in Kinyarwanda is still small, so I eavesdrop for the words that I know. They pop out, like the accented notes in a song, and I can use them to anchor myself in the melody, to hum along with the tune. When my own Kinyarwanda fails in conversation with the waitress, we can plaster up the rhythmic holes in French. Don't hire me as an interpreter in these tongues, or even worse, between them. But after 3 months on the road, passing through 5 countries and 8 languages, it's comforting to wrap myself in familiar sounds, to feel at home in the grammar crackling around me.
Je voudrais saluer le courage.
Oui, mais ma sango qui te codo pas.
Ist das Volk auf die Straße gegangen?
To be close enough, to get some meaning, but still far enough to hear the song.
Gina Moore is a freelance journalist living in Rwanda. This piece was supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting.
It's only words. And words are all I have.
We have lots more about words ahead.
I'm doing this book today. This is my first time doing this book. It's new.
Mackinton Lewis works for a program called Lee Lee Lee, which means read, read, read in Creole. He's known as, what else? A reader.
Coming up, how are Haiti's kids doing these days? We check in after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Imagine being a child in Haiti today. 80% of the schools in and around Port-au-Prince were destroyed in January's earthquake, so kids live in makeshift camps with little to do. But if you stroll through one of those camps today, you might hear this. That's a reader, one of half a dozen adults moving through tent camps, bringing children stories and a love for books. Amanda Thiroff reports from Port-au-Prince.
In the courtyard of a public high school, about 20 kids sit in neat rows on a big blue tarp, waiting for story time to begin. They don't go to school here. They live here, some in donated tents, others in more makeshift structures built from tarps and sticks.
I'm doing this book today. This is my first time doing this book. It's new.
Mackinton Lewis works for a program called Lee Lee Lee, which means read, read, read in Creole. He's known as, what else? A reader. After rallying the kids, Mackinton starts to read from a book called The Zoo Book. It's shaped like a zebra. What animal is this? Mackinton asks. An elephant, the kids shout in unison. Some teenage boys linger on the side.
too cool for this, but not walking away.
We started with 17 kids. And by the time I finished my first book, it was like 30 kids. And it come 40, and kids keep on coming.
Chances are, none of these kids will be going back to school this fall. Although education in Haiti is supposed to be free, schools charge fees for things like books and uniforms. Too expensive for the vast majority of families right now.
We was like targeting like the kids that didn't have nothing. That was our whole purpose. Like, it's not like the States. Every kids, every night your moms read a book for you. They're not used to that. That's not in Haitian culture. What Lilili doing is reading books to them, giving them something they never had.
The Lilili program doesn't actually teach children to read, but its goal is to help kids learn to love reading and to have some fun.
For the 1 hour that we have them kids over here, they will forget about everything. It's guaranteed. Yeah, they focus on the books and like, they forgot what happened in the earthquake. They forgot everything.
Children have a lot of stress and anxiety and fear since the earthquake.
That's Lilili's co-founder, Michelle Kershan. She's an American who's been working on social justice issues in Haiti for the past 20 years.
We're trying to give them some images and stories that they can carry with them through the day and the night.
Kershan meets with Lilili's 6 readers to sift through donated books and choose the ones they'll use. Most are in English or French, so readers translate the books into Haitian Creole, the kids' first language. They're careful not to choose anything that would be too stressful or traumatic. Something like The Three Little Pigs, where the wolf huffs and puffs and blows the house down, that would be out. But some less obvious books have been rejected by Lilili.
Good Night Moon, it's a book to help put your child to sleep. And so it just reviews the room and your comfy bed and the nice pictures on the wall and the nice carpet and the cat sleeping on the carpet. And it's just lovely and melodic and rhythmic, but it's centered on your room. And most children in Port-au-Prince don't have a room anymore.
Even books that seem safe can cause unintentional pain. Mackinton remembers reading the book Aladdin to a group of kids when something unexpected happened.
This girl, like, she was looking at me and the girl started crying. I'm like, what's going on? Like, and she told me, yeah, I had a friend and friend died in an earthquake. I'm like, why you cry when I'm reading the book? She like, no, when you're reading the book, you make me. I mean, she will love that book. That's why I cry, because I know she will love that book you was reading.
Back at story time, Mackinton stops reading when it starts to rain. It's the kind of tropical rainstorm where the water comes down in sheets. It beats down on the tents, soaking the ground beneath them. We seek cover under a big tree, where I ask 12-year-old Women's Yumensha about her favorite story she's heard through Lilili. She tells me it's a book about toys that come to life. And after she heard it, she had a dream.
I dreamt that I had a lot of toys, and everyone came to my house to play with them. A girl took one of my toys home with her, and I went after her to get it back. And when I was running, I woke up, and I saw it was just a dream, and there were no toys in the house.
The kids may worry over a lack of toys, but they and their parents have other things on their mind, like where they'll live. Right now, that's the biggest problem for the people camping out here. The school is too damaged for students to attend classes inside, so it's likely it will need to hold them in the courtyard. But right now, it's full of tents. Residents worry that when school opens, they'll be kicked out. To where? They don't know. Mackinton closes his book and the kids clap, sitting in front of the school's crumbling facade. Mackinton will be back next week, so long as the kids are here. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amanda Thiroff in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Filmmaker Stuart Bamforth thought of a novel way to help Haitian kids deal with their stress and trauma. Bamforth works with the aid group Save the Children UK. He started a children's film project in a temporary camp in Laogan. That's the epicenter of January's earthquake. Bamforth gave video cameras to 6 kids and taught each of them how to film their daily lives. One of the main TV networks in Britain, ITV, is following the children's progress over the next year and will even broadcast some of their films. Stuart Bamforth takes us back to the beginning of the story.
Everyone we met in Laogan has a member of their family who was taken during the earthquake. I mean, the whole town is touched by this tragedy in one way or another. So the difficult thing was, in a way, choosing the kids, because there were so many children there who all really wanted to take part in this project. But we chose the sort of the six kids which we absolutely couldn't say no to. One would be a director, one would be an interviewer, one would be an interviewee, one would be doing camera, one would be doing sound. And we trained them in a way so that they were operating as a professional crew, basically.
So they could go around in this makeshift camp and record each other's stories of what they had been through during the earthquake and after?
It's exactly that. And we had some quite interesting results.
Yeah, I want to talk about a couple of the kids that you have featured and the things they've recorded so far. Let's start with the 13-year-old little girl named Dershi.
This is my grandmother. This is my little sister. This is my mom. This is my auntie.
Stuart, she seemed pretty happy, even though she was kind of in a tent camp. She wanted to show off her family, and yet they were living in a very cramped quarters. Can you tell us a little about her family story?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head there. That was one of the things that struck us, was that despite the terrible, terrible conditions, these children showed up every day with big smiles on their faces, ready to engage and learn. I was only there for a matter of weeks. You know, I was hot and bothered and looking pretty disheveled. And these children were putting me to shame with the way they were just, you know, turning up every morning early, just ready to sort of grab the camera and to tell their stories to the rest of the world.
Yeah, there's another boy featured in the project whose name is Nanel. He actually narrates some of where he was and what he was doing the day of the earthquake. And then when you hear Nanel tell a story, he's actually sitting on the rubble of his house. Let's play a clip from the video about him.
Je sens que je manque un gros bagaille parce que j'aime moi m'étais en bas comme ça.
I feel like I'm missing something huge. I'm no longer the way I was. I had everything I needed. Now everything has been destroyed. I became really scared and started to run faster. I got home and saw Mom covered in dirt. The gate and house had collapsed. I asked her, "Where are the rest of the kids?" She said, "They are still in the house."
Can you tell us a little about his family story, Stuart?
Sure. On the day of January 12th, he was living at home with his family. And his mother was telling him he shouldn't go out and play football. He should stay in and do his homework. And he decided as a teenager that he was going to go out and play football anyway. And he did that. During the football game, that's when the earthquake struck. And by the time he made his way back to the house, three of his siblings had died.
You know, I found it kind of difficult watching him sitting there on the rubble of his house. And it made me wonder, has this retelling of the stories on video for these children been therapeutic, or does it risk bringing their trauma back?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very important question. And it's something which, has concerned me, certainly when we were planning this project. I think what's important here with this project is that it's the children who are both asking the questions as well as answering the questions. I think, you know, one could say that if there was an adult TV crew who were just parachuting in from another country and pushing cameras and microphones in these children's face, asking them to tell us about their trauma, then, you know, there's possibly a risk of that being intrusive or inappropriate. With the training that we did with these children, we didn't set the agenda at all. In fact, we just let them set the subjects for themselves. And to be honest, within a day or two, they were already asking each other, "Where were you when the earthquake struck?" And what we found was that, particularly with a number of the children, it turned out that it was actually the first time that they'd spoken about their experiences during the earthquake, which surprised me. And from the feedback we got from some of the children, they did find it actually a therapeutic experience.
Can you summarize for me some of that feedback? What do the children say after they see themselves on film telling their stories?
Well, while we were filming the scene of Nanel sitting on the rubble of his family's destroyed house, a couple of the other children were making fun of him for one reason or another. And he responded by saying, I have to be filmed. I have to tell my story because I have to get it out of my head. You know, this is absolutely the biggest event that's happened in Haiti in the last 100 years, never mind in these, you know, 10, 12 and 13 year olds' lives.
So I can see how this filmmaking workshop gives the kids something to do and helps them therapeutically to tell their stories and share them with each other. I'm wondering, what do you do with these films? Is it just for them or are the videos showing somewhere else?
Well, I mean, yeah, hopefully the children do get something out of it. But also there's a need for their story to be heard in the rest of the world. The children made a number of films initially when we visited. And after we left from the first visit, we left behind a number of these small flip cameras for them to keep with them and record some of their key moments, you know, birthdays or returning to school and so forth. And some of those films or clips from those films are shown on the ITV News TV program.
So what kind of response are you getting about these kids?
We've had an amazing response. The key challenge is to continue that response. I mean, you know, the news agenda moves on very, very quickly. And, you know, when I returned from Haiti the first time, I was picked up by a taxi driver at London Heathrow Airport. And he said, so is it all sorted out there then? It's all cleaned up and, you know, they fixed up all the houses and everything. I mean, you know, it's a long haul project. We're talking about at least 10 years before everything is put back, even to the condition it was in before the earthquake. So we're encouraging the children to continue filming so that they can give us more and more update films and the international audience can get a real feel firsthand for how the recovery is progressing.
Stuart Bamforth is with Save the Children UK and joined us from London. Stuart, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
You can see video clips of all the children and you can follow their progress over the year. Just go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. California's Central Valley produces fruit and vegetables for the nation, but hard times have forced many of the valley's farm workers to struggle to find food for themselves. In this next story, Pauline Bartoloni reports on one woman who's working to end hunger in California's breadbasket.
Orange Cove is a small city tucked away behind miles of citrus groves. You might never come across this Central Valley community unless you're a farm worker, or you've come to help them.
Everybody who wants to get food, they can receive food.
Mika Gillen is here to do just that. She's come today with a flatbed truck full of food to give away.
Organizations don't like to come out here because there's some gangs out here and stuff. But for me, that doesn't matter.
Gillen runs an organization called Miracles in Community, and she describes it as a food ministry. The 55-year-old comes to this town, one of many she serves, about once a month, bringing goods she gets from a food bank or from anywhere else she can get donations.
There's always somebody calling me up. A couple weeks ago, Fresno Produce called me and they gave me 3 pallets of sliced apples. So on the way home, I'm calling somebody or calling people, hey, come and help me get rid of sliced apples.
All right, get that? Bring 5 at a time and then do 10 at a time.
While Gillen sets up in the parking lot in front of City Hall, locals come walking in from all directions. People like 60-year-old Frida Rudy.
Economically wise, it's very hard for everybody. A lot of people aren't able to work. If they're working, trying to pick oranges is a couple days a week, maybe three days a week if they're lucky.
Over the past 3.5 years, demand at the Fresno Community Food Bank, serving several Central Valley counties, has increased fourfold. That's due in part to a 3-year drought, which the valley is still reeling from despite heavy rains this year. And farm production was dealt another big blow by a federal order to protect endangered fish. The ruling cut back on water flowing to Central Valley farmers. That meant fewer crops and, in turn, fewer jobs.
Okay, you're going to take it out there,
maybe? Yeah, I just pulled it out.
All right.
As for her job, Gillen operates a food truck on the weekends. She used to have a catering business, but that went under when the recession hit. At that same time, she was also going through a family crisis.
One of my friends says, you know what, maybe this is a time for you to get back to the Lord. And this is the only thing you know how to do, Mika, is do food. So why don't you take your trailer out there and give out a free breakfast, you know. And I said to myself at that time, I said, you gotta be crazy, I'm so busy already, you know, I don't have time for that, you know.
But that's exactly what she did. And 2.5 years later, she's still serving people. She says it's something she's just called by God to do.
Yes.
20 miles away is Selma, California, the self-proclaimed raisin capital of the world. A food bank worker hands out tickets to people snaked around a dusty parking lot. Until recently, the state government had funded these massive drought relief food giveaways. This one benefited more than 7,000 people. Gillen brought out some 50 volunteers to help. She introduced me to Josefina Paramo, who lent a hand while she waited to receive a food ration. The mother of two has been working in the orange fields for 20 years. When there's a lot of work, she said, she earns about $300 to $400 a week. But this past spring, she made less than half that.
It's really hard because we have just enough to pay for where we live, power, gas, and all the necessities. The thing is, we produce for other nations, we produce for other states, and there is little left for us, very little.
Gillen says the people who need her food these days aren't just farm workers. The recession has hit everyone, from prison guards to nurses.
I've heard a lot of more divorces going on, and a lot more depression, people on depression pills. And so it's just a lot, you know. It takes a toll on a person. And I've heard of parents say that they won't eat, you know, a meal, or they'll skip a meal or two for the day so the kids can have a meal for the day.
Buenas noches. Buenas noches.
Stories like that are what keeps Gillen motivated to keep serving the many hungry mouths in the nation's breadbasket. For the World Vision Report, I'm Pauline Bartolone in Fresno County, California.
There's a video to go with this story. Check it out on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Coming up, counting and counting and counting. India's census is underway, and it's not without controversy. Stay tuned for that story. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. India is in the middle of a massive census. More than 1 billion people will be counted. For the first time in 80 years, everyone will be asked to identify which caste they belong to. Sunita Thakur reports.
I'm standing outside a construction site in one of the posh neighborhoods of South Delhi. Another set of plush flats being built for the well-to-do. And one can say fairly safely that just as those living in the flats will come from upper castes, those working as day labor on the site are from lower castes. The government already has a handle of the number of people in the lowest caste, namely the Dalits, who used to be known as untouchables. Their caste status has continued to be included in the census, and a certain percentage of college admissions and government jobs are set aside for them in the name of economic empowerment. The rest of the population stopped being asked their affiliation in 1931. At the time, it was believed too many people were falsely identifying themselves as high caste. This time around, it's the OBCs, or other backward classes, as they are called here, which make up around 41% of the Indian population, that are most likely to gain from the caste question in the upcoming census. Rajendra Memgai is the director of the Indian Institute of Dalit Studies.
But one of the advantages what I could see in this census...
One advantage I could see is that the caste census will give a lot of data about different castes, and that'll provide information about which groups are not benefiting or are being left behind in terms of affirmative action. So policy planners will have more information.
People in OBCs are eligible for affirmative action. But advocates estimate that their numbers are woefully underestimated. So an accurate count could likely result in a higher percentage of slots for them. Anantu Das is 23.
He leads a hectic life, going house to house cleaning cars early morning, then working as a part-time driver. As someone belonging to an OBC, he has no doubt that the caste question will be valuable.
Yes,
the census should ask about caste. I'm studying for a degree and do other courses also so that I can go ahead in life. If I could have more government support like Dalits get, then perhaps I could also get a government job.
Shamul Das makes a living as a welder, fixing doors and window frames to newly built houses, and in the evening, studying for a degree through a correspondence course. He too believes caste should be included in the census. In fact, he once tried to pass himself off as a Dalit so he could get benefits.
I myself tried to get a Dalit caste certificate because you pay less fees, get free books and uniforms. If affirmative policies change to include more of us tomorrow, then of course I will stay in my own caste. Nobody wants to join another caste otherwise.
But on the other end of the spectrum, there is concern among upper castes that soon there'll be no opportunities left for them. Ritu Shom is an upper caste housewife, living in a wealthy neighborhood of South Delhi.
If we are throwing a lot of opportunities in the name of caste for a certain section of the society, then where do the children of the upper caste, so-called upper castes, they go to?
But upper castes still dominate professions such as law, medicine and journalism. Again, the director of the Institute of Dalit Studies, Rajendra Memgain.
One can see that, you know, there is a kind of, you know...
There's a clear-cut distinction between caste and occupational hierarchy. One can see a very visible discrimination in occupations. For example, house cleaning people will come from low castes. Also, in the labor market, even when they have the same education and skill training, a lower caste person may not get a call for an interview, and even if called, will not be given a job.
There's no question that especially over the past two decades, better education and urbanization has widened horizons and loosened the bonds of caste. Ironically, the government here believes it may need to provide more caste-based affirmative action to create an equal playing field for all. For World Vision Report, this is Sunita Thakur in Delhi, India.
Many Indians are familiar with this song. It's India's answer to High School Musical, and it's top of the charts in Delhi this week.
Yada teri yada aati hai, ja meri jaan jaati hai, tanhaiyon mein rehta hu.
That was Ekuda from a popular Bollywood film. It's sung by Salim Merchant.
I'm Vibha Iyer from Delhi, India, and you're listening to the World Vision Report.
And now we go to East Timor for our global guru.
Welcome to The Global Guru. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. This week we ask one simple question, just one, from somewhere in the world. Today we're in East Timor asking, what's an umalulik?
It's round and a little bit high-rise, tall.
It's on stilts? Tall.
Yeah.
Is it on stilts?
Yeah.
This is Constancio Pinto.
I'm the ambassador of Timor-Leste to the United States.
He's describing the variety of umaluliks, or sacred houses, that all villages have.
The east would have a kind of rectangle, not triangle, still with the four poles. Under it, they keep the chickens or pigs. And you would have the shape of a cone on top of the earth. So there's only a little door that you can crawl in.
Pinto says they negotiate cattle and land disputes, or even cast away the bad juju from past generations.
Uma Lulik has many roles in the community. One of them is the conflict resolution, and another is marriage, for example, and also protection.
A village elder manages the Uma Lulik. He's judge, doctor, and wise man.
They have so much natural power.
Pinto recounts a tale about a famous one.
The elderly people, they can tell a cow to walk up the stairs and go into the house and lie down and die. Literally died there.
Inside, they're mostly empty, except for...
Surik. Surik is a Timorese sword.
The sword only leaves the Uma Lulik on rare occasions, like when people gathered them to fight for independence in the 1970s.
And that was the first time where they took the swords out from the cases to fight the enemy.
It worked. They got their independence. But Pinto says problems followed.
We tried to solve the problems, either through dialogue, negotiations, and all this, but never worked. Then we realized, okay, maybe this is something connected with the Lulik. So let's go back to Lulik and ask for forgiveness.
Pinto says the swords were too great a temptation for people to use them. They had to be put away. So government got the various groups together, and they had ceremonies and asked for forgiveness from the Lulik.
And also for them to make a promise that they will never engage in conflict, and then to put the swords back into their cases.
That was back in 2008. And Pinto says...
So far, we haven't had any problem. So I thought, to me, I think it's working, yes.
The Global Guru is produced in association with American University's College of Arts and Sciences and WAMU 88.5 in Washington, D.C. Original theme by The Plush Interiors. To submit ideas, email globalguru@american.edu. I'm Rachel Louise Snyder. Thanks for listening.
Cycling has taken off in a big way in the U.S. That means business is good for FK Day. He's the CEO and co-founder of SRAM, a high-end bicycle parts company. But FK is not just passionate about cycling. He's also passionate about helping people. In 2004, he delivered more than 24,000 bikes to victims of the tsunami. And these days, he works full-time with the nonprofit he created called World Bicycle Relief. FK joins us now from Chicago. Well, FK, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Peggy. Great to be here.
Let's talk about these bikes that you had made. Is this similar to a bike I might ride in my neighborhood?
Actually, the bikes that we use in developing countries are very different than what you would ride in your neighborhood. I affectionately call it 55 pounds of love. The bikes we use are completely steel bikes, steel frames, steel rims. They're single speed. In developing countries, they use their bike like a pickup truck, like a workhorse. So what you try to do is develop a bike that can carry heavy loads, that's simple to repair, that can be relied upon day after day in a field of abuse, that can be repaired with existing parts out in the field or repaired with a rock if you have to.
Yeah, you know, because you do hear, I've heard some about these stories of people bringing bikes to the developing world, and then years later, after all the ceremonies and deliveries and first usage, you find these bikes on the sides of the road, and they're in total disrepair, and no one can use them because they don't have any way to repair them. How do you help them be independent with the bike so that when the bike breaks down, which inevitably it will, they can fix it themselves?
That's a really good point. At the moment, we train mechanics at about a ratio of one mechanic to every 50 bikes delivered into the field. We try to bring people in from the field selected by their communities to come in for training. And oftentimes they'll have a little bit of knowledge of bicycle repair, but then we'll take them in and we give them five hardcore days of not only bicycle mechanics training, but business training, how to take out a micro loan, inventory control, what is profit and loss. So we've provided two things there. One, someone with a skill set and a livelihood that they can build on, that's the mechanic. And then the other we've provided with an extraordinary, revolutionary tool in the bicycle that now has the ability to be repaired when it needs to be.
And FK, I know you've been over there, you've been on the ground, you've seen these bikes make a real difference in the lives of people. Any stories that come to mind when you think of the dramatic ways your bikes are making a difference?
Yeah, well, the bikes are used absolutely for economic development. You know, there's examples all over the place, and there's one that I just crack up about because I see this guy fairly frequently in Zambia. And what this guy did is he would buy young goats from one village, he'd bring them home, feed them, and then walk to another village and sell the slightly larger goat. So he was kind of doing goat arbitrage, which I thought was a really, really cool economic concept. And what a bike gave him the ability to do was carry more goats, more round trips, and then sell them in more distant villages, and therefore increase his basic income, increase the flow of goods between villages. And he ended up buying probably three or four other bikes and hiring two or three other people for his growing business. Now, to us, goat arbitrage isn't too sexy, but I'll tell you what, to that guy and the people he employed and the people he sold and traded goats with, that was a revolutionary concept.
I love that story about the guy with the goats, but I'm trying to picture this man carting goats around on a bike from village to village. How does he transport goats on a bike?
Well, we made sure that the bikes we build can be modified any way you want them. We have a very strong carrier or rack on the back of the bike that allows people to weld cages onto it if they want to, or rope in big baskets. And this particular guy actually pieced together some old destroyed bicycles and made a really interesting carrier on the back of his bike. Pretty innovative, but hunger definitely promotes innovation.
Are there any other ways these bikes are being used?
Yeah, we're running a large-scale program right now in education, primarily biased to the girl students. And one of the primary reasons why people drop out of school is the distance between their homes and school. If they have to walk, you know, 2, 3, 4 hours each way to school, oftentimes the parents go, you know, I just can't lose that much work during the day to you walk into school. And the first people that get taken out of school are the girl students. So we said, okay, let's run a large-scale program and target the areas of the highest poverty rate, cross-referenced with the highest dropout rate, and begin to provide carefully selected students, particularly girl students, 70% girl students, with bicycles, and let's reconnect them to schools and see how that goes. So we worked very closely with the communities and the Department of Education, this is in Zambia, to design this program, and we've put in about 7,000 bikes so far, and the results are unbelievable. You know, kids are getting back into school. They're staying in school. The other day I heard that pregnancies were down. It's like, wait, we've only been doing this for a year. And it's simply because the girls are beginning to get back in school, have the confidence to say no. Their parents aren't putting them into early marriages. There is hope for their future. And it's just the results are unbelievable.
Have you talked to any of the girls after they've been riding bikes to school and had this opportunity to get an education because of a bike?
Oh, it's amazing. So I spend a lot. I'm very fortunate to be able to spend a lot of time working in Africa, and then come back with the stories in my heart. And I remember one in particular who was just on the verge of dropping out because she had to wake up before the sun rose, do her chores at home, spend about 3 hours walking to school. Then she'd work at school, try really hard, come back home, have to do her chores at home, and then there would be no time for her to do her homework. But with the bicycle, she was just thrilled. Suddenly, she said, I was going to have to drop out of school, but now I'm going to stay in school, and I'm going to get into high school, and I'm going to become a doctor after getting my college degree. You know, that fight within her was just mesmerizing. It resolved the fight in me to keep driving and improving the program and bringing it and making it available to more and more areas.
FK Day is with World Bicycle Relief. FK, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peggy.
We should add that in distributing their bikes, World Bicycle Relief often works with World Vision, the nonprofit organization that funds this show. And that brings us to the end of our show this week. You can download a podcast at our website, worldvisionreport.org, and you can read blogs from our reporters around the world. And of course, you can follow us on Facebook and on Twitter. The show is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Katie Davis, Ilana Hadler-Pearl, and Jenny Schmidt are our editors this week. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepard are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening. I want to ride my bicycle.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.